Today is Thursday, November 21st, 2019. This is a part two Grand Canyon Oral History interview with John Weisheit, spelled W-E-I-S-H-E-I-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, John. How are you tonight?
Just dandy.
Thank you. Good. Thank you so much for your willingness to carry on with this interview. May I have your permission to record this conversation?
Of course.
Thank you very much. At the end of part one, it was 1979, 1980. You'd been working in Phoenix on a lot of construction that was happening there. But somewhere in there, you ended up taking a fiberglass boat way up into the headwaters of Lake Mead, up into the western end of Grand Canyon, past Separation Canyon, up to Nice Canyon, quite a ways up there against a flow of current. I think you remembered, you mentioned you'd camped out and the boat was high and dry in the morning. And a river trip went by and they were laughing and you thought, I want to do that.
Yes.
And can you pick the thread up from there?
Well, yeah, I would have to wait. Because I didn't know anything. I didn't even know there were commercial trips or private trips. I knew people were going down the river. I didn't understand how it worked back then. But, you know, I just logged it in my mind. I'm going to do that someday.
Okay.
And, you know, I put it to rest at the time. And sure enough, it wasn't very much longer after that. It starts with my parents. They had very good friends, Alan and Mimi Paul, and they did lots of things together, outdoor things. And they did do a commercial river trip with Arizona River Runners in 1978.
Okay.
And I think Connie Tibbetts was the boat person. She was her inaugural trip, you know, running a boat, not a swamper. Anyway, they had a great time. They got commemorative t-shirts and everything. But, you know, they decided that they were going to do this on their own from that point on. So Alan was good about getting the permits. And he got a desolation permit, and they invited me to go. We rented 16-foot yampas from the company in Green River, Utah. It's, I don't remember the name. It's the company that was owned by, his name.
So not D. Holiday, it's not
no, it's a cowboy.
Not the Quists.
Not a Necker.
Not
a Quist. He died in an airplane crash in about 20 years ago, I think.
Kayaker?
No, he was hanging out in Robber's Roost. He's somehow related to, maybe it was Ecker. I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm wasting tape time.
No worries.
Anyway, and there was one of his boatmen. I think his name was Steve Acerson.
How do you spell Steve's last name?
A-C-E-R-S-O-N.
Okay.
So anyway, we rented those, and we used them for shuttle services. They took us to Sand Wash, and that was the very, you know, that's my first overnight river trip. I mean, I've done daily river trips in canoes.
Do you remember the month and year of that trip?
It was like May.
Okay.
It was delightful. There were didn't know about Desolation Canyon mosquitoes until much later.
Okay. The water would have been coming up, maybe?
Yeah, it was 20,000.
Okay.
Anyway, we had a great time. I mean, I just loved it. I said, you know, I'm going to do this again. And
what do you, wait, before you go away, what do you remember about that trip? Who was on it? What, when you think back on it now, what do you remember about it?
Well, it was, actually, it were just, there were 8 people on that trip in 2 boats.
Okay.
And Teresa Yates, myself, we were married at the time.
Okay.
And Mimi and Alan Paul, Don and Donna Weisheit, and some friends. I can't remember their last names. When it comes time to type out the narrative, I'll fill in these blanks.
Okay.
So anyway, we just, you know, we hiked, played cards, cooked, did all the fun things that you do on a private river trip. It was just absolutely glorious. Made our own decisions, scouted, learned how to operate oars. I you know, I did okay. We did take turns. I didn't dominate the oars. It must have been a 7-day trip, as I recall.
Okay.
So it was, and we had 20,000, so it was very leisurely.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
And in the spring, no mosquitoes, per se.
Lots of flowers.
Oh, my.
Big, shady cottonwood trees. I loved it. Still, like Desolation, I would rather do a Desolation Canyon trip than any other. I mean, I've done them all, but mm-hmm. Deso is my favorite.
Nice.
If there's such a thing as a favorite, if you know, I have a problem with that word, actually.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, I'm just glad to be on any river, any section. It doesn't really matter. I think the reason why I like Deso the most is it looks more authentic than the others. All the others are kind of mangled by dam operations.
Okay.
And Cataract is in good shape too. Until you get out of the national park and into Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, then it's a national disaster area.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But, you know, Deso starts and ends in a very pristine wilderness. And it's a treasure. I don't even think I want to say that because people who read this might want to do it. You know? Keep it a secret. But it doesn't get as much use. And actually, this is an interesting thing. I've been looking at statistics. There's less people going down the river than there used to be. I'm trying to figure out why that is.
Interesting.
I mean, I did 4 Cataract Canyon trips this year, and when I was down there, there was nobody there. All 4 times.
Nice. That's a good thing.
It is a good thing. What's going on? Are people more interested in doing one-day things and not committing themselves to overnight longer trips?
That's what I've been told in the commercial world is happening.
It's very obvious. I think the glory days are over with. It's going to be very different in the future, I think.
Well, we shall see. In the meantime, 1981, Deso started its river management plan in the 70s. And so you would have had to get a permit.
Yep, we did.
And did you, you know, everybody wore their life jackets? How did that extra oars? And did you pack out your solid waste at that time?
Yes, okay. We did. Things haven't really changed since then.
Okay. Did you run into any other river trips that?
Yes. I don't remember it being uncomfortably crowded. I thought the spacing, the ability to get camps was good. It was just a nice, perfect trip.
Nice.
It was a great introduction to, you know, how it's how it should be.
All right, and so this is in May of 1981.
No, 1980.
Sorry, May of 1980. Okay, and you're living in Phoenix at the time?
Yes.
All right, and working construction.
Yep.
And then what happened?
Well, so I'm looking for boats. Of course, I don't have a lot of money. Boats are expensive, brand new.
Hmm.
And then you have to do the frame, you need trailers, you need vehicles, you know, so. I'm searching newspaper ads for boats, and I was lucky. There's this guy in that moved to Phoenix who was interested in selling two 10-mans and one 7-man. These are military surplus from World War II.
Yeah.
And I got all three of those boats for $800.
Wow.
And I bought them.
Who was the guy who sold them? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I just know he lived in Idaho and he moved to Phoenix and he didn't want them anymore. And I don't blame him. They needed a lot of attention. This is how, buying those boats is how I got into doing river trips with Georgie White.
How so?
Well, so I, they needed work. They were neoprene, cotton neoprene.
Okay.
Master Tire and Rubber, Findlay, Ohio was the manufacturer. They're defunct. You know, I'm trying to call people to like, what kind of glue, what kind of rubber do I, you know, how do I do this? And
hey, John.
Yeah.
What was the manufacturer again?
Master Tire and Rubber.
Ester, E-S-T-E-R?
No, Master, Master.
Master, okay.
Yeah.
Never heard of them.
Findlay, Ohio. F-I-N-D-L-E-Y.
Never heard of it.
Neither did I.
Okay. Were they still in business?
No.
Okay.
So, I went to the Phoenix Library. Get on the card catalog system, and they're looking in, you know, River Runners, Grand Canyon, Colorado River, and there's this book by about Georgie White called 30 Years of River Running, and I checked it out, and I read the book, and, you know, this is the days before internet, so then I saw... She lived in Las Vegas, so I got a Las Vegas phone book out, found her phone number. I didn't actually call her. I actually got her, I wrote her a letter.
Hmm.
And all it said was, I have these old 10-mans and a 7-man, and I see you used to run them, and I'm hoping you can help me. What? Well, how do I do that patching and stuff like that? Just a simple question. You know, and I gave her my phone number, and but she wrote back and she said, well, I work with Dave Demery in Friendsville, Maryland. Demery Inflatable Boats, I think. And call him up and get the glue and the rubber you need. And then, by the way, I need a swamper this coming May. Would you like to be my swamper? And I said, you mean you're going to give me a free trip down the Grand Canyon? She said, yeah. I said, yeah, I'll go.
So this is 1981 then?
No, that was 1985.
Oh.
Sorry, there's some time lapses there.
Yeah, so let's try to fill in this gap from May of 1980.
Oops, sorry.
To May of 1985. Are you okay?
I'm sweeping my floor, Tom. It's really dirty in this kitchen.
Talking on the phone is a good time to sweep the floor. It really is. That's good.
No, I'm keeps me from.
Yeah, that's good. I'm with you. So after that trip in May of 1980, did you simply go back and work construction for 3 or 4 more years, or did you do more river running?
Well, I did do some more river running. My parents applied for another permit in 1982, and it was for the San Juan.
Okay.
And I don't think... I don't remember where the boats came from. I'm trying to think if they were my old 10-mans. I don't think I had gotten them yet.
Did your parents?
I know. We rented boats from the same people in Green River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And, yeah, so we launched at Sand Island and went all the way to Clay Hills. And, of course, Lake Powell was full in 1982. So I got my first experience of running from a river into a reservoir.
Okay.
Buried rapids.
So let's talk about that trip. Do you remember the month, 1982?
Yeah, these were all May-June trips.
Okay. So the flow, I don't know, might have been 2 to 5,000, something like that? What did you have flow-wise?
Yeah, it wasn't extraordinarily. Yeah, 2 to 5,000 sounds right.
Okay.
Real
and
easy.
There's some wonderful, you start at Sand Wash there. No, Sand Island, I'm sorry. And head downstream, there's a wonderful petroglyph panels and ancestral Pueblo and dwellings.
Yeah, Butler Wash.
Buildings, Butler Wash and River House Ruin. Or a river house pueblo. What did you think about that?
Well, yeah, that's a nice panel. So I'm getting. Well, don't forget, you know, I'm really interested in Native American heritage and culture, and you know that's why I was to the point when I saw him buried by Lake Powell. I'm in distress.
Okay.
And, you know, so it was nice, you know, and I learned that at Deso, true, because you went, you know, like you went to Flat Canyon, those ruins, you know, those petroglyphs are outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I'm beginning to appreciate, you know, that there were people before.
Okay. And then, you pass Mexican Hat on the San Juan, maybe day two. I'm not sure how many days your 1982 river trip was.
Yeah, it was a week-long trip as well.
Okay. You go for days with no roads and no power lines, no train tracks, just like on Deso Gray. And eventually, as you say, you go past Slickhorn Canyon, and suddenly you come into the headwaters of Lake Powell, and the current stops, and there's a lot of silt and braided channels, and instead of heading on to the confluence with the Colorado River, the takeout is off to the north there. Oh, actually, in 82, did you go down to Paiute Farms and take out there?
No. Did not.
Okay. That's right. So you guys would have been heading north. So you would have taken off at Clay Hills and then headed back to get the boats back to Green River. That would have made sense. Yeah. Anything else you remember about that San Juan trip? Did you run into other trips? Did you meet other people? And besides the First Nation exposure.
Yeah, you know, I learned about anticlines.
Okay. Yep. structural geology right there.
Yeah. Entrenched meanders.
Okay.
I learned about the oil and gas industry.
Ah.
That's something that was very profound to me because in those days, oil and gas were relics from the 1910s and 20s. And, you know, there were no modern-day gas and oil in the Colorado Plateau in the 1980s. And that started changing in the Reagan administration. All of a sudden, drill rigs are showing up on your put-ins, especially for Desso in the Uinta Basin.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the first profound change that I witnessed.
Okay.
Other than dams, now we have these oil and gas intrusions. So yeah, I realized that, what did Abby said? You're holding a tombstone in reference to the Colorado Plateau's transformation from a arid lands wilderness to a all kinds of commercial enterprises ranging from oil and gas extraction to tourism and so on.
And John, you had mentioned Abby's The Monkey Wrench Gang in the 70s when that book had come out. During this period, 1980, 82, 83, what else were you reading at the time?
Well, there were a series of books that came out in the early 80s. Three authors in particular, Mark Reisner, Cadillac Desert.
Okay.
Philip Fredkin, A River No More, and my favorite, Rivers of Empire by Donald Worster.
Okay.
And so I was reading that stuff. I was learning a very different Colorado River, the one that the 1902 Reclamation Act transformed, and the Colorado River Compact of 1922. The Boulder Canyon Project Act of 1928, the Colorado River Storage Project Act of 1956, and the Colorado River Basin Project of 1968, you know, and then I'm learning about Bridge Canyon Dam Site and Marble Canyon Dam Site and the Sierra Club, and now I'm starting to get into things like Encounters with the Archdruid, the story of Floyd Dominey and David Brower on a river trip with John McPhee.
Well, it's interesting thinking about Desso. You mentioned desolation kind of looks sort of as it should. It has a number of major dams upstream of it. Certainly a Flaming Gorge comes right to mind, but it also has a number of undammed tributaries, the Yampa, the White, Duchesne and others, and the San Juan as well. In 1982, of course, had Navajo Dam upstream, and its flow had been greatly reduced, curbed by that dam. Was this about the time then, 82, that you became aware that these rivers didn't look like they used to?
Yeah. Well, there were other things that were happening to augment that feeling, which is the flood of 1983. And some of the, so like, you know, they had to, for example, speaking of Navajo Dam, they had to evacuate water out of Navajo because it was piping, it was leaking, and they did an emergency release. And this was on a San Juan River trip in 83 or 84. This is the trip where I actually met Bill Belknap. We shared a camp together at Honaker Trail, but it was flowing 15,000.
Woohoo!
Yeah, the gradient there is like 15, 16, 17 feet a mile. So, I mean, we're cooking. I mean, you know, we're eating breakfast, and then we're camping 2 hours later.
Right. It's like an hour and a half on the water, and then it's time to camp.
Yeah. So, you know, hey, let's go hike the top of Honaker Trail.
Okay. So I really want to stop for a minute, and I want to know about your recollections of Bill Belknap before we talk about Bill.
Yeah.
between the high water San Juan trip of 83 and your May 1982 San Juan trip, did you do any other river trips between those two?
Yes, I started doing San Juan river trips.
Okay, in the summer of 82?
Not San Juan. Well, I did do some San Juan trips, not with family this time, but with friends.
Okay.
Now I'm expanding to share, you know, I'm feeling confident. Let's invite some friends.
Still getting the rental boats from Green River?
No, I think, you know, by this time I have these, I haven't written Georgie yet. That was 1985. So I must have, I know what I was doing. I was patching my boat with make-believe ideas.
Ah.
Now I remember. Thank you.
So I was
using shoe goo and like bicycle tire patching stuff,
you know,
which works, but not forever.
Right. So you actually bought the 10 man's and the 7 man 1982-ish then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so suddenly you've got boats. How did you build frames for those? Did you use aluminum or did you just use 2x6s?
Yeah, I just looked at the pictures I saw in Georgie's book and I saw 2x6s, 2x8s. And so, and I remember how Steve Acerson's frames were on his boats.
Okay.
His rubber crafter boats. And so I just imitated him.
Okay.
You know, and in those days, you know, it was 3/4 inch pipe and tire leather and hose clamps.
Okay.
And so that was, you know, my rig. It was not, it was all very, you know.
We look at it as elementary now, but at the time, it was a state of the art, more or less. It might not have been spanking brand new, but wooden frames were the name of the game.
Yes.
And oars, what did you do for oars?
Where did I buy them? Gosh, you're asking good questions. Well, I bought some. I don't know where. I must have, didn't have Amazon.com back then.
No. And you didn't have the friendly boating supply, you know, on the internet and or in town even.
Yeah, what did I do? You know, I remember whenever I went through Flagstaff, that's what I did. I went to the old outfitters in Flagstaff and asked them if they had any old shit that they wanted to get rid of.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I bought oars. I bought rocket boxes. Ammo cans, you know, the stuff they were going to get rid of. I think I talked to George Marsick a lot.
Okay.
In those days. You remember him?
No, but you're going to tell me all about him. Please do. How do you spell his last name?
Marsick, M-A-R-S-I-K. I think he worked for Arda or Azra.
Okay.
At the time, and I think then he moved, he started a Salt River outfitting organization or company on his own doing Salt River trips. You know, I never met him. Always talk, whenever I visited a warehouse, I talked to some young boatman, warehouse guy. Never actually met him.
Okay. But he was helpful in getting you squared away on.
Yeah.
Okay. On oars. Were you running pins and clips or open oar locks? Do you remember?
Tire rubber and hose clamps.
That's interesting.
3/4 inch galvanized pipe.
So the oars had a little, like an inchworm sort of curve of rubber bolt, a band clamp to the oar, and that hole between the rubber and the oar slid down over the pipe. Is that how that worked?
That's what I did.
That's kind of interesting. Okay.
Well, I didn't know, Tom.
No.
There's a
fascinating film from the 1950s showing Harry Elson taking a sheet of rubber, and he has a wooden block that he's bolted to the rubber, and the block's got a little oar lock on it, and he's gluing this down onto the Tin Man.
Remember, I've seen that picture, Tom.
As an orlock, and the boat that Georgie donated to Grand Canyon Museum Collection has an orlock just like Harry glued down.
Okay.
So that was the bee's knees for a little while. And pins and clips and open orlocks and rubber tire orlocks here.
Yeah.
Okay.
I admit it. I was being a copycat with the things I saw in Georgie's books and whatnot.
Well, so was everybody else.
Yeah.
So do you have any idea roughly how many San Juan trips you did in 92?
In 92?
I'm sorry, 1982.
Oh, I bet by 1985 I had done 4 trips.
Okay, and so you're coming up from Phoenix, I'm assuming then you actually did take out at Paiute Farms?
No, took out at Clay Hills every time.
Really?
Yeah.
Because?
Well, because our vehicles were at Sand Wash, and it was the fastest way to get, Sand Island.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our shuttle drivers lived in Bluff.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Because I know a lot of the Flagstaff people were gearing out of Paiute Farms, and they would work their shuttles out and run at that side on the...
Oh, that makes sense if you're going to Flagstaff.
Right. Yeah. But I'm thinking you were from Phoenix, so... It might have put you even further, you know, down south of Flagstaff, so maybe you worked out that side, but not. Let's go to 1983. It's high water. The San Juan's running 15,000. Did that, you know, you're like, oh, well, it's another day on the San Juan. I guess, did you think it was normally like that, or did you know at the time there were trouble upstream at the Navajo Dam?
Well, yeah, you know, I knew it was unusual because we didn't have that when we started. And Bill, we're camped at Honecker Trail, and Bill Belknap shows up in his cute little sport yacht.
Was it just Bill, or did he have other people with him?
It was a commercial trip.
Okay.
Fast Water Navigation was the name of the company, I think.
Right.
And there was a female guide. He had a boat named after a German character. It was blue. It was fiberglass. It wasn't a traditional Sporiak 2 or 3. It was handmade.
Wow.
It had a self-bailing hole.
Wow.
In the bilge. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It had a Kilroy is Here logo on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Bill, God, he has the best tan on the planet. That guy was brown, and he never wore a shirt. And you could tell. He wore a hat. But anyway, he explained to me that there was a release coming down Navajo, and that's why. And, you know, the sand at Honecker Trail was caving in, or calving in.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we said, we'll let you camp here. We'll just move downstream, which we did. And we tied up on this sandbank, and a sand caved in on my boat and totally buried it.
Wow.
So I had to spend the day shoveling sand out of my boat.
Amazing.
So yeah, there was a lot of sand excavation. I mean, so San Juan's losing sediment.
Right.
Too,
right.
Big time.
Certainly. So Bill's first river trip was in, I believe, 1950 with on the Hudson Expedition, as Marston wanted it to be called. Did he talk about the early days? Did you even know to ask him about?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I just, you know, I had a Belknap River Guide. That's the guy who makes the maps. You know, he has his family history in those maps.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I knew who he was. I was thrilled to meet him.
Cool.
But he was very business. He had customers to take care of.
Okay.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Did he hike him up the Hanukkah Trail there?
Yes, he did.
Okay. Nice. At that time, was there a sign-in for camps down at Slickhorn? Had that been instituted by then?
Yes, there were.
Okay.
Oh, you know, I remember what impressed me about Bill is all his customers were running their own boats.
Oh, yes. Everybody had their own sport yacht.
They were, yeah, they were, I thought, wow, this is way cool. Everybody gets to, they're equal. There's no hierarchy. Except Bill, you know, making sure they don't miss camp or
mm-hmm.
a nice lunch spot, you know. You know, and that's actually how Tagalong Expedition started. You followed Mitch Williams in your own Jeep.
Okay.
You know, so in those days, it wasn't client-customer. It was everybody was on the same tier. And when I look back on that, I think all our river trips should be on the same tier, no hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I'm looking back too, and that's the way it is with guides. You have junior guides, senior guides, and old timer guides, and you know, they're all, it's almost a caste system.
Interesting.
Actually, I know that bothered me back then because that's part of the reason why I didn't want to be a Grand Canyon guide, because I felt like I was in the India caste system. That there were untouchables and there were Brahmins, and you know, and I just thought, oh my God, this is so high school.
I'm assuming that you would have had to do a Grand Canyon trip to experience that.
Yeah, I did.
And when did that happen?
Well, went back to now. It's May 1985. You know.
Okay.
Georgie's, and but you know, I forgot. You know, I did a Dolores River trip in 1983.
High water.
High water. You know, 10,000 cubic feet per second.
Yahoo!
Memorial Day weekend. It was a zoo. There were 500 people on the river that day.
Wow.
You know, that was the other thing that I learned, you know, so now I'm going, oh, now I understand what the permit system is about.
Ah.
You know, they don't have a permit system on the Dolores because, you know, at the time, you know, that was, you know, McPhee was about, the gates at McPhee were going to close.
Okay.
Everybody knew the gates were going to be closed at McPhee, and this was the last time to do the Dolores River.
Wow.
On a natural flow. And we didn't put it at Bradfield, we put in at Dove Creek. And there were a zillion people there. I mean, it was just a clusterfuck.
Hmm.
But I had a great time. I thought, like, this is really cool. And,
did you go all the way down to the confluence?
No. These were friends from Phoenix, construction workers. They all had to get back, so.
Okay.
Which is unfortunate because that's the, you know, if I had known how beautiful it is between gypsum and bedrock, I would, you know, to this day, I have never been so charmed by a river.
Hmm.
The section between gypsum and bedrock is just off the charts, incredibly wonderful.
Nice. Yep. And that was 83.
That was 83.
Okay. So, the San Juan, Desolation Gray, Dolores. What else did you run in this time period from 1982 to 1985?
The Salt.
Okay.
And
now the Salt is a really interesting river because it has no dam control. And it is really snowpack dependent or storm dependent. And you have to be very quick if you want to try to run the storms because the water goes up and down and really fast. So I'm assuming you ran that in the spring of one of those years?
Yeah, it was, we're talking March, April.
Okay. Water was cold, but the
Didn't, yeah,
flowers would have been nice.
yeah, we, it was usually somewhere between 5 and 10,000.
Okay. And this would have been pre-Quartzite Falls dynamiting.
Yes, learned about portaging
Okay.
and how heavy 10-mans are. It. It's cool. There's sycamores. The geology's off the charts. The saguaros, the beaches, the gravel, the rocks. You have to pay attention. It's a great, great, great river trout.
Nice. And
But
you've.
yeah, I would actually take the time, Tom, to go up there and do dailies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from the bridge to Sibicu.
Okay.
Get up early in the morning, run up there, and and I was desperate. I had it really bad. I would do whatever it took to get there.
Okay. So, as Marston called it, the Rapids Rabies.
Yeah, that I had it big time, really bad.
Did you get up on the Gila at all at that time?
No, but I had heard about the Gila box. I went, Suzette and I went to do that about 10 years ago, and we brought our inflatable kayaks, and because it was running, and by the time we got there, it dropped, and we weren't able to go.
Wow. Okay. All right. I'm just, trying to think of any of the other rivers that might have attracted you at the time that were anywhere near Phoenix. Well, of course, that's the Salt, but what about the Verde?
No, never did the Verde.
Okay.
Sure wish I had.
And again, 10-man's on the Salt. Okay, so your boats are seeing, they're seeing some good use. San Juan and the Salt, that's good. And anything else you want to talk about in this 82 to 85 period, as you're learning how to run rivers, and how to set up camp and take camp down, and what you need to do to rig, put the trip together, clean up and take the trip apart when you get home.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, that, nothing special there. But I will say my rowing skills were not very good because I never had anybody to ever tell me I was doing anything wrong.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And or that there was nobody to say, hey, there's a better way to do this.
Or watch my run, do it like this.
Never did. For 6 years, I didn't have anything like that, Tom. I just kind of like had to figure it out on my own.
Okay. Well, that can be good. I mean, you need to learn how to read water. I'm going to back up a minute here. When did you get married to Teresa?
Oh my, 19. I was 25, so I was 1979.
Okay. And is she on the San Juan trips and the Salt with
Yeah.
you? And okay. Meanwhile, in Phoenix, what was happening with your construction work? Was that changing at all? Were you working up a ladder? Were you starting to do your own stuff that way, or were you still working for others in a crews? How did that work?
At first, it was a little bit of everything, and then eventually I kind of specialized and just did cleanups.
Okay.
Teresa and I did that together as a couple.
Okay.
But I developed I was one of those guys who got home and drank a quart of beer. And then, like 5 years later, I'm drinking 3 quarts of beer.
Okay.
And then 5 years later, I'm drinking a box of wine.
A day.
And so I found out the hard way that I have that gene.
Ah.
And so I had to suffer through that for a while. That was not a lot of fun. By this time, I'm a commercial boater, you know, and I'm one of those guys who's drinking on the job. And
Okay.
I'm drinking in the morning, and you know, in those days you could get away with it.
Let's go back for a minute, because we'll just carry that thread with us as we go. Because I'm assuming that when you had the business going in Phoenix, in the first half of the 1980s, you weren't drinking on the job. You'd come home and drink a six pack.
Yeah,
Okay.
but then I was drinking before lunch.
You mean eventually?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, alcoholism is an interesting journey.
Oh, it is a journey. I don't regret it. I just kind of wish I kind of picked up on it sooner. Because I wasted a lot of time, you know?
Yeah.
Needlessly. It's a great, if you get sober, yeah, it's a great learning tool.
Right.
Yeah, there's it's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, if you make it through.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the key.
I mean, whether it's recreational drugs or alcohol, it's yeah. Yeah. Well, that's
Yeah, the other drugs didn't really interest me. Yeah, I'm a classic alcoholic.
Okay. Maybe it's time to introduce that first river trip in Grand Canyon with Georgie in 1985.
Yeah, where you can drink as much beer as you want all day long.
Oh, okay. So you had written Georgie. She wrote back, and you started a sort of a pen pal exchange with her.
No, she just,
She wrote back and said, "Come boat with me."
yeah, the very that was her response.
Okay.
Come boat with me. And I, God, my parents and Teresa drove me up to Lee's Ferry. We hung out with Georgie, you know, and those it took her 3 days to rig her at her G-rig. You know,
So explain to me how Georgie did that.
well, so she would show up with her crew. In those days, it was half firemen and half friends from Las Vegas.
Okay. So half
And,
fireman from LA.
yeah.
Okay.
And she would get there 3 days before her launch.
Okay.
And she would throw her rubber out of these big trucks. Not semi-size, more like U-Haul size.
Sort of stake bed kind of trucks,
Yeah,
2-ton sort of things, or
they were enclosed.
okay.
And inflate them, rope it all together. It was a truly a spider web of rope. Everything was in old military bags, neoprene bags.
The black bags.
Black bags.
Okay. And that but so there's a couple different sizes of those. There's sort of the generator box black bag, which is, I don't know, 2.5 by 2.5 by 1.5 feet, and then there's the smaller regular sort of water type black bag that's
Yes.
a foot by a foot by a foot and a half.
Yes, and they were marked, you
Okay.
know, they were day one,
Okay.
day two.
She was doing that in 1955.
There was a bread bag. they were called 10 bags. They just had the number 10 on them.
Okay.
And they were filled with Coors, only one product, Coors.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, you know, there was first aid and all the other things, and, you know, everything, there was no metal on her. There are no ammo cans. In the engine compartment area, there was a wood frame, motor, and compartment transom that she had had. I mean, it's the one she started. I mean, that thing was 30 years old. I think her friend Elgin made it for her.
Elgin Pierce.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then there was a big steel box that was just full of ice, insulated. Aluminum, actually, not steel, sorry. And in there was lunch meat, salad goods, perishables.
Okay. Where did that go? Was that, like, in front of this wooden frame that had the transom and the motor on it?
That went in the middle boat. So the middle boat, the port and starboard boats were 33.
Okay.
And the center boat was 37. And the engine compartment food, icebox, spare motor. It was a single unit. You know, today they're mostly made out of aluminum.
Yep.
But hers was wood.
Okay. So let's spend a little time, if you don't mind, and help me envision this. The 33-foot long ovals are very long. They're not super wide. The tubes are about 3 feet in diameter, maybe.
Yes.
And originally, these surplus 33s and the 37s had a sheet of rubber that ran the full length of the floor of the boat. And so if you inflated the thing all up and you put it in the water, you could stand on this sheet of rubber and be dry. You know, unless it rained or water splashed up over the tubes. Were these still in the boat, or had they been removed?
They had been removed. But actually, these were brand new boats.
Okay. These were dibs?
They were dibs.
Okay.
I think, like, the year before, she might have done that.
Okay.
She cut the floor out of those old boats.
Right.
Yeah, they were self-bailing boats. And I think she had just bought these dib boats because they were really brand new.
Okay. So
maybe it was the second year for them. I can't recall.
Let's talk about the port and starboard 33s. Did she have any kind of frame that dropped in them, or was there just a center tube that kind of looked like a pill? You know, sort of any kind of little capsule pill that you might take for a cold or something.
Yeah.
That would nestle down in the inside of the donut or the oval.
Yes.
So you'd have to tie all that in, and then everybody would kind of sit on top of that, and their gear and whatnot would be lashed onto those ovals.
Yeah, they were backrests. You didn't see.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
they're actually very cushy.
Yeah. Yeah, and in early days they were black. I'm assuming this was maybe blue. It was a different, wasn't as hot.
It was silver.
Silver, okay. And then the center oval, the 37, did that have a center pill tube as well?
Yes, it did.
And so then the cooler, the aluminum box, would that sit behind the pill?
Yes.
And then
it's only maybe 6 feet.
Okay.
7 feet long.
Yeah, it would be hard to manhandle. You'd have to get a bunch of people on it, I suppose, when it was full of ice. Or
yes.
did you put it in and load it up? No, it would have been loaded with food already.
Yeah, I think she had a crane.
Ah, okay.
I mean, you know, it was mounted to the roof of the
The steak bag.
This is right. This is a long time ago.
No, you're doing great. I mean, we're just trying to. I mean, that's only 30 years ago.
35.
Okay. Yeah. In theory, on the steak bed truck, there could have very easily been a little hand winch, kind of little crane thing.
Yeah, but everything, you know, was small and manageable. It was very feminine, you know.
Uh-huh.
There's no 45-gallon gas tanks. Everything's in a 6.
Okay.
Everything's manageable.
All right.
Nothing heavy. The heaviest things was the metal insulated, this aluminum insulated cooler, and the two motors.
Okay.
Everything else was under 35 pounds.
All right.
Maybe even less.
So small bite-sized chunks of stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
Well organized and labeled.
Georgie had a name for that triple rig. Do you remember what that name was?
She called it a G-rig.
Okay.
G stands for Georgie.
Yep. Well, I had heard names, the Queen Mary, the elephant rig. Do those names ring a bell at all?
Having read a lot of the Marston collection, yeah, I think a lot of that came from
other river runners.
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember I was telling you about the hierarchy and how sometimes it's like high school.
Well, maybe now's a good time for you to talk about that. Did you experience that there at the three days of rigging?
Yeah.
What was it all about? What was happening?
Well, you know, there were people Georgie would talk to, and there were people who Georgie would not talk to.
Like who?
Oh, I can't remember. I didn't even know who these people were.
Okay.
There was definitely them, and there was definitely us, and you know, and it just was competitive.
Okay.
And, you know, oh, she's new, or oh, you know. So, you know, I kind of like picked up on that. Like, the politics was the Lee's Ferry politics.
Okay.
I noticed that right away, and I went, this is kind of weird.
Ah.
Because, you know, you have to remember, that's not the way it works on a private trip in down to San Juan, you know.
Right.
The Rangers are nice and hell, you know, they didn't have guns. They told you what to expect and what kind of fun things to do, and now everything is so militaristic, you know.
Hmm. There was another question I realized I wanted to ask you, but I forgot about it, so I'm going to go back and ask you about that. Georgie had two types of craft. She had the big rig, and she had thrill boats, at least in the 50s. Now, the trouble with the thrill craft was they were three 10-mans tied together with oars on the port and starboard 10-mans, like a big scow. What that meant was that the big rig had to go basically at oar speed. And eventually the river concessionaires realized that that was burning up too many user days and they needed to go faster. By 1985, did Georgie still have the thrill craft? Or was she just running two motor rigs?
She was just running. There were no thrill boats.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that particular year they weren't on the schedule.
Okay.
She, there was a turning point there, you know. This is post-1983.
Right.
She broke her arm in 83 or 84. She actually had to let somebody else run her boat, you know, which was her domain for, you know, sharing the motor.
That was her motor. I mean, it was her space, her turf.
But she was starting to relinquish that.
Ah.
She was, Bob Sederberg was, there were only a few boatmen from LA Fire Department that she trusted. One was Bob Setterberg, and the other was Brownie, who actually had a great time. I thought Georgie's boatmen are not naturalists by any means. Brownie was. Brownie could tell you about geology. He had a narrative. He was fun to listen to.
What was Brownie's full name? Do you remember?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Big, bushy mustache. Just a delightful person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really liked him.
Okay. And this is going to be a 12-day or 10-day trip to the lake?
Yeah, with helicopter. Was it 10? No, I think.
Or faster, 8 maybe?
They were fast. I think they were 9 days to Pierce.
Okay.
And with helicopter exchange at Whitmore.
Okay.
Or across the river from Whitmore.
Yep. All right, so 3 days in the hot sun to rig these boats and tie them all together, and you're beginning to learn that there's an in-group and a new group.
Yeah.
And how did that first trip go?
Well, I was delighted. I don't even remember if I had a camera. I had a diary. I was just enthralled. I just felt really privileged to even be there.
Okay.
I felt very that I didn't have to pay for it, and that I was getting all the beer I could ever want.
Oh wow! Okay. And Teresa was on that trip as well?
No, but she was enthralled with Teresa.
Okay.
And she, after my trip was over with, she invited Teresa to go on the next one. And so I stayed. When I was on the river, Teresa, did work. And I did the same. So now that I think about it, I don't think Teresa and I ever did a trip together. It was
with Georgie?
Yeah, I would do one, and she would do one, and then I would do one, and she would do. I only did 4.
Okay. Just that summer of 1985, or did you work for her other summers?
86, too.
Okay.
85 and 86.
All right. During that time, did you ever get a chance to sit down with Georgie and get her to talking about the old days and what she was thinking about life before and after the dam?
Yeah, I did. She didn't like the dam.
Okay.
She enjoyed her Glen Canyon trips.
Okay.
She was more adventurous. She was doing different rivers, and then she became a homebody, Grand Canyon only.
Okay.
You have to realize she didn't have staff. It was just her and her sister. That was staff.
Okay.
Everybody else was just invited to join the trip, and, the firemen were on paid vacations, and they had first aid.
Right.
So, she really wasn't a legitimate company. She was a hobbyist. And she ran very unique and different trips.
How so?
They were her way. You learn about Georgie. You learn about different places and different canyons, but you don't really learn. She didn't go on all the hikes. We did the hikes with the other crew, you know, and the other crew is, they're not really trained in natural or human history. I mean, they're not deep interpretive trips.
Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of like a trip with Georgie was a glorified private trip.
Okay. Interesting. You know, I'd heard from someone else we talked, and they had done a couple Georgie trips, and this was in the 80s, and they mentioned that actually there wasn't a lot of hiking, and Georgie kind of wanted people to stay close to the boat and on the beach and not wander off. And I think there's, you know, it's good reason you don't want to wander off, you don't know where you're going, but was that correct? Was that your impression on the trips you were on?
Yeah, we didn't do any loop hikes, you know. Hell's Chasm was a typical stop. Deer Creek, you know, I think we went up to the top and back down. Never went up to Nacogdoches Ruins.
Really? Okay.
I remember going to Saddle Canyon once. Of course, we would stop at Redwall Cavern.
Yep.
Didn't stop at Santa and blew by.
Ah.
She never scouted. Didn't really have to. You know, in 85, there was high water. We had 50,000, right? We, you know, Hance was significant, Crystal was significant, Lava was kind of washed out.
Okay.
Yeah, it was kind of nice to see. I haven't seen Grand Canyon that high since.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was cool.
Right.
You know?
It's interesting because, like I say, Georgie didn't scout. And she was also known for sort of just going right down the meat of everything with this giant boat.
Yeah, she did. She at Hance, Crystal, and Lava, she would set up and then pull the motor, lock it, you know, and then she would, with her helmet on, which is a construction helmet.
Yep.
And she would just, you know, tuck down inside her motor compartment and just ride it, you know. And if the boat went sideways, it went sideways. If it went backwards, it went backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, it was very stable. I never felt like this thing would ever pancake. We, of course, discussed it. Like, is it safe? You know, but, you know, by the time, you know, you realize it's not really a dangerous boat, I don't think, quite. But I know she's had problems in 83, but a lot of people did.
Right. There are some films of the 50s into the 60s that show some pancaking happening with the big rig, especially in Lava. I wonder if she learned eventually to rig that boat differently so it wouldn't make what was well known by then as a Georgie sandwich.
Yeah, you know, triple rigs still happen. I know Holiday has ropes underneath the triple rig to prevent that.
Okay.
But I never saw Georgie do that.
Okay.
There were no belly straps underneath the boat.
Ah, okay. Yeah, and I didn't realize that term Georgie sandwich had started in the early by the mid 50s. That word was out there. So it was happening, and
well, the boat died with her, you know.
Mm.
Nobody.
Good point.
there's Ken's light triple rigged, Holiday triple rigged, and I think the Green River company that we rented our boats from triple rigged. But
okay.
Now only Holiday does. They're the only ones left.
And there, no, but nobody's running triple rig in Grand Canyon. When Georgie passed, that was it.
Yeah, that was the end of that, you know. And
okay.
Ken Slight hasn't been down there since the early 80s.
Okay. All right.
So there you go.
Did Teresa keep working with Georgie after that 86 summer?
Yeah.
Okay.
She did. Don't know how many times.
Okay. Was that about the time?
Wait. No, I. Well, yeah, I think that's true. I lost favor with Georgie because it's in the Richard Westwood book. I started inviting some of her clients on Salt River trips.
Ooh.
And I didn't realize I had done a no-no. And then, so there's another awakening for me, Tom. I can't be friends with Georgie's clients. She thought, you know, she thought I was going to, like, charge these people or something. You know, I'm like, I was on her territory and I got on her shit list.
Wow. Okay. Huh. What was that like?
It was fine with me. I was ready to go.
Okay.
Like, this is not what I want to do.
It's interesting because earlier, like this year, I interviewed someone who also came to the Grand Canyon scene and found it the same way. Didn't use the caste word, but found it very much. You were either in the in crowd or you were not. And as an outsider, it was very much.
It's bullshit, is what it is.
Well, what it did for them was it steered them off to other rivers, and they did really amazing work there, and that sounds very familiar to what's happening with you.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, here's what I think. This is what I mean by it's bullshit. It's not about the place anymore. It's about people and boats.
Okay.
And the business. It's not about the place. And that's what disturbs me. The protectionism.
Okay.
They're protecting their company, their jobs, their position. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
It's corporate.
Okay.
It's like, you know, the Sharks of Wall Street in a way. Not quite as intense, but. You know, it's. Maybe I'm just sensitive to that stuff. I don't know. I just didn't like it.
It's interesting looking at this historically. It's a land of river gods. Even in the 50s, in the early 50s, that term was being kicked around. And it's a land of big egos. And so I was thinking about how that might fit in with what you're thinking about.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, and the older they are, the more they have.
Okay.
Here's why I know it. When I came to Moab, it was there, but it wasn't pervasive.
Okay.
It didn't reek. And, you know, that's when I went, it can be different in other places.
Ah, okay.
You know, so this is definitely a cultural thing.
Okay. You mean a unique to Grand Canyon thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that's just the way it is.
Okay. Interesting. Do you have any idea where that may be coming from? Or let me rephrase that. And when did you find a similarity between Grand Canyon and Dinosaur that you didn't find in Canyonlands and Desolation?
Well, that's an interesting way of putting this. A lot of that hierarchy is not around anymore.
Okay.
Because river guides don't last very long anymore. you know, they move on
after okay.
5 or 6 years.
All right.
When I showed up, you know, I was being trained by people who had been river guides for 15 years, 20 years. You know, they were career guides. They died as river guides.
Okay.
So that dynamic isn't around anymore. In fact, the younger guides don't even really care about those older guides or anything, you know. The river guides, the other thing that is different between the Grand Canyon and the Upper Basin is we have snow melts, and we have driftwood, and we have low water, and we have medium water, and we have high water, and we have bugs, which is great because it means your ecosystem is working.
Yeah.
And so, and we're also, we're a lot more friendlier. We like, help each other out.
Mm-hmm,
and, mm-hmm. Oh, is my car in the way? I'll move it. you know, there's still some grumpy old badass boatmen that still act like, this is my boat ramp. This is my boat.
Mm-hmm.
This is my trip. There are some, that is not that is here too. But most of the time, we just like maybe because we're a smaller town and we see each other at the post office. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a. Yeah, you know, interesting.
So you know, and you know, but they're crusty up here. They're gnarly. You know, they're not anymore. But when I started, like I said, I didn't know anything about anything, and I was eager to learn. And they picked up on that right away, and they gave me so much information. I was on information overload. They gave me so much good advice that, you know, that I now know was true and tested and sincere.
So,
and they gave it to me for free, and I just want to share this with the younger guides, but they don't care.
Okay. Some
of them do. Some of them actually call me up and buy me lunch and, you know, tell me about the old days.
Right.
But that's, you know, that doesn't really happen anymore.
I'm gonna jump in here and say, we've been at this an hour and 20 minutes. Once again, our chariot is turning into a pumpkin, and maybe this 1985, 1986 time period is a good time to wrap this interview up. And because it sounds like here you're going to head to Moab in 86, 87, is that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So.
And I'm going to get sober.
Okay. All right. So that might be, I want that story.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, what's cool is, I got to talk about this, is when I did my first cat trip, the last rapid was Big Drop 3.
Oh, okay. So the reservoir is really up.
And the concrete boat ramp is completely underwater. I mean, the boat ramp in 1986 was 10 feet long.
This is at height. At height, you mean?
Yeah, because the rest of it was underwater.
Oh, because of the high water, the management of the dam and that whole deal. Okay.
There's no place to park the trash. You could throw your trash from the boat into the trash can.
Okay, wait. I got a zillion questions for you now. Stop. I kind of want to go, well, with that, thank you very much. We'll wrap up this interview. there's a whole vista of things to talk about in front of us. Looking back at what we've just discussed, is there anything else you want to grab and put into that before we head off into some amazing new topics of discussion here?
Well, the 90s turned out to be the glory years, and that was the peak. It's gone. The amount of trips we were doing were off the charts. The money we were making was for river guides was amazing, and you know, companies have sold, management has changed, it's just a different place.
Okay.
Decline and decay.
Well, hold that thought. I wanna capture and explore all of that. But I think at this time maybe let's just wrap up part two and we'll head in that direction in part three.
Okay.
All right.
We have been talking for an hour and a half.
Well, actually, an hour and 22 minutes and 3 seconds. So there you go, with the little timer on the machine here. So today is Thursday, November 21, 2019. This concludes part two, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with John Weisheit. My name is Tom Martin. And John, thank you so very much.